circuit. And so that we can predict some current about that. Good. So at this point, I will make a note of this. If I hope I won't forget this.
You spend many words and speak in many ways in this subject.
You see, why such a long disquisition there on the sit you are alone? Yes. So the thing which bothers us, the length of this disquisition, bothers even the many. Yes.
Excuse me, humans, I should even now, if you see any possible way in which evil can be explained as other than pain, or good as other than pleasure, you may still retract. Are you satisfied, then, at having a life of pleasure which is without pain? If you are, and if you are unable to show any good or evil which does not end in pleasure and pain, here are the consequences.
Yeah. Now, Suresh, you see, by the emphasis, he speaks here alone for himself. If you were to ask me, I would reply. He dissociates himself now from Protagoras. In other words, he reminds Protagoras of the difference between them regarding the relation of the good and the pleasant, or regarding the relation of courage and wisdom. Sukadev tells these people, these many, by what you have already admitted, you are already refuted. He gives them an opportunity to retract their admission, just as Sukadev had given it to Protagoras. He treats the many as he had treated Protagoras. And this is of course justified because we do not know where Protagoras stands. Maybe he shares the view of the many. Yes?
If what you say is true, then the statement is absurd, which affirms that a man often does evil knowingly when he might abstain, because he is seduced and overpowered by pleasure. Or again, when you say that a man knowingly refuses to do what is good, because he is overcome by pleasure of the moment. And that this is ridiculous will be evident if only we give up the use of various names, such as pleasant and painful, and good and evil. As there are two things, let us call them by two names, first good and evil, and then pleasant and painful. Assuming this, let us go on to say that a man does evil knowing that he does evil. But someone will ask, why? Because he is overcome, is the first.
No, but if someone asks us,
why? Because he is overcome, is the first answer. And by what is he overcome?
No, we did not. He is overcome. We did say. By what? That one, the questioner, will ask us.
And by what is he overcome? The inquirer will proceed to ask us. And we shall no longer be able to reply, by pleasure, for the name of pleasure has been exchanged for that of good. In our answer, then, we shall only say that he is overcome. By what, he will reiterate, by the good we shall have to reply.
Fine, so. Now, is this, the proposal of Socrates is extremely simple. If the good is the pleasant and the bad is the unpleasant, then let us use only one of these pairs of opposites, otherwise we confuse the issue. Let us speak either of good and bad or of pleasant and unpleasant. Now, if he applies this to the phrase here discussed, if the good is a pleasant, it is ridiculous to say men choose the bad knowing that it is bad because they are overcome by the pleasure. For they mean that men choose the bad knowing that it is bad because they are overcome by the good. A ridiculous statement. And this is emphasized by the fact that Socrates swears here by Zeus. You know, he swears very rarely in the Protagoras, apart from the Hippocrates section, very few oaths. Only one oath of Protagoras, one oath of Prodicus, and one oath of Socrates. And this is the last one, after a long time. Who swears? Obviously, Socrates and someone else, because he says, by the good, we shall say by Zeus. Not necessarily. It could be Socrates alone. It could also mean that it belongs to the sermon, to the people who make the sermon. And it's very dark. And this is, yes, and now. Go on.
Nay, but our questioner will be joined with a laugh if he be one of the swaggering sort.
Immediately after the oath, there is this reference to the hubristae, to the men of insolent pride, or the men given to mockery and laughing. Yes?
That is too ridiculous that a man should do what he knows to be evil when he ought not, because he is overcome by good. Is that, he will ask, because the good was worthy or not worthy of conquering the evil? And in answer to that, we shall obviously reply, because it was not worthy. For if it had been worthy, then he who, as we say, was overcome by pleasure, would not have been wrong. But how?
So if we blame this man, therefore the thing which he preferred must not have deserved being preferred, yes?
But how, he will reply, can the good be unworthy of the evil?
He will say perhaps. Why he omits it, I do not know.
He will perhaps reply, can the good be unworthy of the evil, or the evil of the good? Is not the real explanation that they are out of proportion to one another, either as greater and smaller, or more and fewer? This we cannot deny. And when you speak of being
over... This is now surely speaking together with the many against the invisible questioner with whom he has conjured out of pure clothes. Yes?
And when you speak of being overcome, what do you mean, he will say, but that you choose the greater evil in exchange for the lesser good? Admit it. And now, let us substitute the names of pleasure and pain for good and evil, and say, not as before.
Now, one moment. It's a question, he said here, might solve the difficulty. He might say, perhaps, by saying that man gets the greater evil as a price of the lesser good. And somehow this seems to be a satisfactory answer. Why is it satisfactory? It takes away this, first of all, the whole complication with the two couples of opposites. We have only one couple of opposites. And something else. Well, if you do not see it now, you will see it in the future. Good.
And say, now let us substitute the names of pleasure and pain.
So do you see what Suez proposes? The vulgar statement, the ordinary statement, is in terms of two pairs of opposites. Good and bad, present and unpleasant. And this leads to confusion. Either we must state it in terms of a single pair of opposites. We have stated the difficulty now in terms of the opposites good and bad. And now we state it in terms of the opposite pleasant and unpleasant. Yeah? Suez talks too for slow learners, because others might be able to figure it out on the basis of the first one.
It is that the greater, where the first version of it has been the greater evil, lesser good. Mm-hmm. He has now managed to show that all the being overcome is purely a matter of bad measures.
Yeah, but it is not yet brought out. Exactly. Now let us read the secret.
Substitute pleasure and pain for good and evil. And say, not as before, that a man does what is evil knowingly, but that he does what is painful knowingly, and because he is overcome by pleasure, which is unworthy to overcome. Are there any circumstances in which pleasure is inferior to pain, other than when there is an excess and defect in their mutual relation, which means that they become greater and smaller and more and fewer and differ in degree? For if anyone says, yes, Socrates, but the pleasure of the moment differs widely from future pleasure and pain, to that I should reply, and do they differ in anything but in pleasure and pain? There is nothing else. And do you, like a skillful weigher, put in the balance the pleasures and the pains, and their nearness and distance, and weigh them, and then say which outweighs the other? If you weigh pleasures against pleasures, you of course should take the more and greater. Or if you weigh pains against pains, you should take the fewer and the less. Or if pleasures against pain, then that course of action should be taken, in which the painful is exceeded by the pleasant, whether the distance by the near or the near by the distance, and you should avoid that course of action in which the pleasant is exceeded by the painful. Would you not admit, O humans, that this is true? I know that they cannot deny it. He agreed with me.
Yeah, you see, no direct speech and very... He has the same view. Wholly unemphatic. Protagoras is here in no way visible, as though the whole thing is made for him. Now, the same story is now stated from the point of view of the opposition of the pleasant and the painful. Man chooses the painful, knowing that it is painful, overcome by pleasure. But there is no reference to anything being ridiculous. There is no reference, no use of an oath in this connection, although it's strictly parallel. But something new, more clearer than in the parallel passage, weighing. The thing which will favor is the weighing, measuring, counting of pleasures. And now, this leads then on, we will discuss this in detail next time. Then this leads then on to the proposal. Yeah. What we need is science, wisdom. The science of measuring the good, obeying and counting the good. And that is exactly what the Sophists do. And let us anticipate that we are not completely in the dark. Let us read now 357 D at the end, and E.
And you admit it further that they err, not only from defects of knowledge in general, but of that particular knowledge which, as you also agreed earlier in the discussion, is called measuring. And you are also aware that the erring act which is done without knowledge is done in ignorance. This, therefore, is the meaning of being overcome by pleasure, ignorance, and that the greatest. And our friends, Protagoras and Prodicus and Hippias, declare that they are the physicians of ignorance. But ye, who are under the mistaken impression that ignorance is not the cause, and that the art of which I am speaking cannot be taught, neither go yourselves nor send your children to the Sophists, who are the teachers of these things. Ye are concerned about your money and give them none. And the result is that ye are the worst off both in public and private life.
Yeah. In other words, Socrates makes the case for sophistry much more powerful than Protagoras ever did. He beats him on his home ground. And which means, you know, he has beaten him on many grounds, but now on his own ground. That he is done. So, in other words, now let us look at our poor Hippocrates. After the discussion has arrived at this point, what will Hippocrates do now? I mean, if he do not go beyond that, yeah? To Socrates, why not to Protagoras? I see. No, but if he is a little, if he's slightly less intelligent than you assume, and takes very literally what Socrates says, he would go to again.
The thing to do is to find knowledge, though. Socrates, I think, is standing on very firm ground.
What do you mean by that? I mean, which degree of depth is appropriate?
I know that in the Republic, he places his knowledge certain levels. Now, on if you start that the world of opinion, you move up to the world of direction.
Yeah, but what does this mean if we are confronted with such a specific question here?
Well, I think it's important here.
But, yeah, but still, here we have this point that Sokrates has proven to the satisfaction of the wisest man present, naturally, why to the satisfaction of the wisest man present, Protagoras, Hippias, and Prodigus, why are they satisfied?
To support their intention.
Yeah, to their interest. Very simple. Sure. Just in the case of medicine, would for the goodness of medicine, would not be disliked by the AMA. Or take a similar case. Yeah. That's clear.
It seems to me that the most likely candidate for Hippocrates is Hippias.
Very good. Very good. Yes, why?
Measurable.
So, in other words, Socrates beat the drum for sophistry, but not for the brand of Protagoras. Protagoras had spoken with contempt of the art of measurement. Hippias especially. You see? So Protagoras cannot be too pleased, and if Hippocrates has any understanding, he sees that the notion to go to Protagoras isn't good. Then he has to thread through mathematics, which he won't like anyway, and he won't go there. Sure, that is a little. But still, if that is tried to, that is very, I think it's true. And, good. But what about this argument itself? If we know, if we can measure, weigh, and so on, the pleasures and pains, only then can we make wise choices. We have, of course, well, he gives later on the example the errors we commit regarding things owing to distance and nearness, you know. House looks bigger far away, and so that we have to measure it somewhere, how either directly or indirectly, to see what the true greatness of the house is and not the appearing greatness. Now, the true pleasure afforded by a present beauty queen. This, how do you measure that against the bad consequences? I mean, what are the, well, perhaps you know what the possible bad consequences are, take them into consideration. That's all right. But there is another simple point, a key point, which you have to take into consideration, and where the example is not quite fit, because in the case of things in space, as we say, distances, we measure them. That's not too difficult. But what about the distances in time? In the first place, they past pleasures and pains would, of course, in no way enter into our calculation of future pleasures. And finish. What about the future pleasures and pains? Because of the power of chance. Yeah, but it's still, yes, but there is one key point. How far ahead should you look? Should you look forward to 120 years or only to 70? Makes all the difference. Yeah, or maybe only 50. Furthermore, then there comes up this question. If you are confronted with what we call the presence of death, how is it still possible for most people to measure and count and figure quietly without being afraid of death?
Well,
it's also a point, because we have to consider not only pleasure and pain in the narrow sense, but of course also fear and expectation, painful or pleasurable expectations. There are quite a few difficulties. Yes?
And what about the Samana section, particularly the question of tyrants?
I do not know. I mean, hitherto I have not found a clear sign of that. Still the best we have hitherto in this time. By the way, you must not forget this sketch of a hedonistic doctrine. When Xenophon makes an experiment with hedonism in his dialogue called Hero, he entrusts that to Simonides, the poet Simonides. Simonides, if I remember well, was said to have coined the word hedone, the Greek word for pleasure. And I think Socrates, whatever may be wrong with Simonides, that does not come out in this dialogue. The question more generally stated is why the identification of the good and bad as the basis of the argument. Now, one way of answering the question is, of course, what follows from this premise? What does Socrates get out of it? And we see he gets out of it a justification of suffering, which he is trying to get. In other words, he says, under what condition would it make sense to say that virtue is knowledge and teachable in the way in which the Sophist taught it? And he answers that question in this way. If the object of human action were homogeneous in such a way that they can be figured out, the more and less, by way of measuring and so on, in that case, virtue would be knowledge. But of course, it forgets one little thing. The best art of measuring, so that you would enable a man only to say, this is better than that, would it guarantee that he would overcome the pleasure of the moment, or the fear of the moment, to do that? You know, this would of course remain this difficulty. Now, when we look at that, and I will try to develop this more fully later, courage is the great theme here, you know. And that would mean, in terms of the specific question, being overcome by fear. But instead, the chief subject is overcome by pleasure. Now, what does the silence about being overcome by fear mean? And fear, that's of course a question of courage. Yes?
Well, seeing that it's only in question of being overcome by pleasures that you can even stop for this type of calculation. Being overcome by fear is a much more immediate type of thing.
Think of the beauty queen that you under particularly attractive zone. I mean, I'm not good at developing that, but I hear there are many people today who write write about these matters in great detail. This is perhaps not so simple. But again, you have to consult with it. But surely, I have no doubt that the danger of pressing death, someone pointing a gun at you and you don't have a gun, would probably induce almost all men to forget about present pleasure. Yeah? That is the profound truth underlying Hobbes' doctrine and some other doctrine. You know that. But what I'm trying to use is something else. How should I begin to make this clear? In the Platonic dialogue, we must, of course, always think about the subject matter, in this case, pleasure, pain, fear, etc. But we must also never forget about the individual, the character. Now, the chief character of this dialogue is, as the title indicates, Protagoras. Now, what about Protagoras? Is he such a hero regarding self-control? Yeah, we don't know. But one thing we do know about him, and because he has made it very clear, now let me do like very poor teachers to phrase the question from the end. I will not try any pedagogic tricks, because I wouldn't work at this moment. But there is one striking difference between the pleasures, and that it takes this greatest case that of sexual pleasures, and the fear of death. Now, do we know anything in general about them from the literature, about their distribution in the various age groups? I think we do. And the literature is easily available. Plato's the public, beginning, Gephardus. He's an old man, and he is so glad to be old because he is no longer subject to that savage master sexual desire. But he has another problem instead of it, which he did not have before. What was that? Fear of death. So crudely spoken, this kind of desire, sexual desire, is more characteristic of youth, and fear of death is more characteristic of old age. Where does, and in which group does Protagoras belong? I mean, is he young, is he old? He says so. He could be the father of everyone present. He is as old, let us say, as Gephardus. Does he show any trace of fear of death? I beg your pardon?
He took Socrates' advice regarding speaking in
essence. Sure, but that does not necessarily mean fear of death. It could mean fear of inconvenience. Yeah, if he has to leave town within an hour, that is very unsettled. Yes.
He was cautious about asking whether the good was the pleasant, and he said, looking the rest of the class.
Yes, this was the letter, but does he show in his conduct any sign of fear of death? I believe he can say no. And I will make this tentative suggestion that he is in this sense of the term a courageous man. And then he would have this paradoxical situation, that Hippocrates is courageous, and the potential pupil, and Protagoras, the potential master, teacher, they're courageous at the ground on which they can be. But the thing goes somewhat deeper, and that is the point to which Mr. Burr alluded. Protagoras' peculiarity, as he points out, is his frankness, his candor. He takes a risk at first glance, which no one else has ever taken before. Courageous man. Now, this, from this point of view, certain features which we have observed, but which we have perhaps not sufficiently understood or appreciated, become important. we are in Hades, you know, by the allusions to Homer. Sugarit has gone down to Hades, to the world of the dead. And it is the most, there is nothing dreary or terrible about it. It's just fun. Heracles and Pythagoras was compared in a certain, by indirection, to Achilles, the man of courage. Not to Achilles in Hades, because in Hades, Achilles had lost all belief in courage and said, much better to be a day laborer in the light of the sun than to be a great hero. Now then, of course, we would have to watch and to examine Protagoras' courage, particularly what kind of courage is that. In the case of Hippocrates, we can be sure that this is something, well, you know, this is a young boy, say of 80 or whatever the age is, and who is very good at pursuing runaway slaves. If that is manliness, courage, then it is manliness. No. Is it true manliness? And we would have to raise a question regarding Protagoras' manliness as well. Is his courage due to his wisdom? Then we would have first to know, is he wise? I believe we can say without exaggerating in any way that he is not wise. I mean, a man who says, I teach virtue, and has never given any serious thought to the question of whether virtue is one or many and how the parts are related, cannot be called wise. So his courage is not really different from wisdom. His courage is due to his excellent health and great success in the world, with, i.e. to a kind of being well advised of the kind of it. And above all, a man who says, I come to Athens, and I can make every Athenian good, better than anyone else could ever have made him. That requires a kind of courage, doesn't it? In other words, to what extent is his courage the same as what we would now call his nerve? Now, to take an extreme step, which is, of course, which is necessary as a suggestion, it may be wrong, and it may not be tenable in the long run. Now, he is not wise, this much we know. How far is he moderate and just? It's hard to say, because here he doesn't steal silver spoons or anything else. Impious, we do not know directly, but a bit. Now, let us look at 349d5, the end of 349. Let me finish.
D.
In the following way, you will know that I say the truth.
You will may observe,
yes, many
that
of
many men are utterly unrighteous, impious, self-indulgent, ignorant, who are nevertheless remarkable for their courage.
Could he not involuntarily speak about himself? Yeah, we don't know, we must see. But this does not, I believe it is important, and I must say I was glad when I saw that my mind very closely, first that Hippocrates is courageous, I had completely forgotten that, and then I saw that Protagoras is in a sense very courageous. I mean, is not a man who raises an enormous claim and an enormous gland which he cannot possibly fulfill. Can one not say, in the loose meaning of the word, of this man, that he has an amazing courage? Yes. Yeah, that is clear. I mean, in other words, the question would still remain. We have a very loose usage all the time, it cannot be helped, and it is necessary. Whether in a strict sense of the word, can there be courage without wisdom? Does not courage imply wisdom? That is, of course, Socrates' point. But Protagoras, nevertheless, that might be true. But the question, yes, but I remind you of the three questions in which I started. Why the courage question? I believe I have given at least material useful for an answer in what I just said. Why the pleasure that the hedonistic proposition? Why does it come in? And thirdly, why this long discussion with a human being? So, i.e., a group of men, and we are not Protagoras, but the human being and human beings and their irrelevant opinions about pleasure and pain, things we have not much more. Yes?
I didn't understand on what grounds they were using
Oh, no, that was very strict. You know the answer. No, that was not so visible. I know what you mean, but that it was. Now, later on, when he describes what was going on, he quotes verses from the Odyssey, which Odysseus uses for describing Hades, individuals in Hades, Tantalus and so on. So. There is a fourth question to which I do not have an answer. How to give the examination? I think we need a special session to coach you for the examination.